That song that we all know and love, Leaving Home. Karma, Karma Chameleon.
Beautiful, beautiful baby.
Their cover of Black Sabbath's Paranoid.
Damn it, don't call me Wombo.
How much more big could these songs be?
Wow. This countdown just gets weirder and weirder.
Truly the Big Ten.
We have living legend Paul Simon coming up with right in here at number 5 in the 1997 Hottest 100, given a spin on the Creedence Clearwater Revival classic, Doot Doot Doo, Looking Out My Back Door. I said, where's the fucking song?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the whole thing about this one. Number 5, Pauline Pants Down, Backdoor Man. Really, what we're talking about here is not just a song. We're talking about a real moment for the Hottest 100.
A cultural phenomenon, if you will.
And a real moment for Triple J as a whole. So, this is a song by artist Pauline Pants Down, also known as Simon Hunt, an Australian satirist, and at one point a Senate candidate, who actually at that point had legally changed the name to Pauline Pants Down by deed poll. So that's how it would appear on the actual ballot, which is great. Great little bit of background on that. Prior to parodying Pauline Hanson as Pauline Pants Down, he'd successfully lobbied the Office of Film and Literature Classification to remove homosexuality from its list of adult themes.
So he's a really, really great activist. Yeah, even 100%, now, like super, 100%. Really, really good.
So what you would have heard in that track, which we'll explain why we can't really play, or maybe it'll become obvious by the next thing that I'm going to say, frankly, is segments of Pauline Hanson's actual speech cut up in order to say such things as, I'm a backdoor man, I'm a homosexual, I'm very proud of it. I'm a backdoor man for the Ku Klux Klan with very horrendous plans. I'm a very caring potato.
Very good.
This was layered over, I guess, kind of like a faux kind of disco beat or whatever. Funnily enough, the song that it samples was also sampled by the hit Will Smith song, Men in Black. So when you listen to it, it sounds like you're listening to Men in Black with Pauline Hanson kind
Which
of over the top.
Which does raise the question, what that stand for?
It stands for a lot.
Backdoor man.
Stood for a lot.
B-D-M.
So the story goes that this was a promotional single. It was to promote a lip sync performance that Pauline Pants Down was doing.
In drag.
In drag as Pauline Hanson. For our international listeners, Google Pauline Hanson. I guess. Do some research yourself.
We can't give you everything.
I refuse. So it was released as a single to promote this kind of party. Picked up by Triple J, then played, then became the most requested song that Triple J had. It went absolutely gangbusters, as evidenced by the fact that it's number 5, 2 spots ahead of Radiohead's Paranoid Android.
It was played almost hourly.
Yeah. But only for about 9 days. Then in came the lawyers. Pauline Hanson got word of this whole thing, and there was huge court proceedings where the song was actually ruled to be defamatory. And this was appealed, and then it was ruled again to still be defamatory. There's a lot of stories that have been purported that, again, like, and this is just hearsay and rumor, but there's been some people who said, like, the judge has said in private conversations that they were in a hurry that day and they just wanted to make a ruling and kind of get it out of the way. I'm not saying one way or another about that whole thing.
Love legal systems though, hey. They're just top notch.
They just work for everybody.
If the punk fan has logged on.
If there's any chance that kind of story could even conceivably be true, we always have a great legal system.
So hence, it's injunctioned. The ABC could not play it anymore. And just to be safe, we ourselves have not included it as a sample within this podcast, because we're not really sure how that whole thing plays out.
But if you would like to hear it, it's very easy to Google.
You can find it. So if that's something that you would like in the privacy of your own home,
And it is. And it's a great song.
Yeah.
Let's just get that out of the way.
Well, can't say either way, to be honest. Yeah. I hate to.
I've heard. Allegedly.
Yeah. Allegedly, it's a great song. Allegedly, yeah. It's quite funny and a pretty good satire.
The great legal loophole where if you say allegedly...
you can say anything you want.
I've seen it on TV before.
The other thing to note is that after this, and this is a song that you can hear far more freely, it's a lot easier to get hold of, is that Pants Down released a sequel to this after the injunction known as I Don't Like It.
I Don't Like It.
Which is a direct response to this track and the whole story of it going forward.
It's amazing.
Was that in the next Hot 100?
I'm almost certain it is.
Yes. I was far more familiar with that than this.
Yeah, because that was the much bigger hit.
I think
this couldn't become a hit because it got
works
banned.
Better as like a pop song.
As a song. Yeah. Knowing that...
allegedly.
Is it Greg Hunt was his name?
Simon Hunt.
Simon Hunt. But a good name, like the initial name, Shunt, very good.
The Shunter.
But when the Shunster released the... like, knowing that old Shuntles was a drag queen... was a drag queen makes this song really obvious. Like, it's so obviously a piece of drag performance music. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And that's, you know, the fact that it was supporting a live drag show in the first place is just so important. I think, like, if nothing else, it's the story that is this song.
It's similar in the same way that, not in the sense that it's similar in an obvious way, but like how the first Hot 100, the first winner being asshole, like that as a story is fucking funny and good. And the fact that like a song in the top five got injunction and they couldn't play it on the day of the Hot 100, but people still voted it in and it got to number five is extremely good.
Beat Paranoid Andrew.
That owns.
Yeah.
That's really good.
This is like, allegedly that owns.
Yeah. This is the music community that we want in Australia.
100%
goddamn sense. Like, it's exactly the same as Dennis Leary and, like, Cows with Guns, you know?
And the thing is, like, even if you didn't love this song, and, like, obviously this is not one of the... this is not the fifth best song you heard this year, but, like, if you were voting and you didn't vote for this, you're a cop.
Preach!
It's probably allegedly at least the fifth best cultural event to happen around music in this year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what else is there really to say?
You can't really review the song, can you?
Yeah.
Because it's really
irrelevant. It's about the political statement, man.
Yeah. It's exactly about the political statement, and that's what people were allegedly...
so into it.
So alleged people. In the first place. Yeah. So-called people.
Yeah. Hearsay.
Yeah, exactly.
So we'll talk about old Shuntles soon. Shunty Brewster.
Trying to think of other ones I can use.
I know, no, Shunty Brewster is
the apex. Are you kidding me?
The hits just keep coming and they do not stop coming, my friends. I didn't even realize this, but the great Van Halen. Van Halen have made it into the Hottest 100. They are in at number 4 with a classical take on a Rolling Stones classic, Symphony for the Devil. Symphony by The Verve from Urban Hymns 1997 Triple J Hottest 100. Nathan, you are here.
I am. So this is one of those songs that, like, if I talk to someone about this song and they don't like it, and in part that's because of how completely oversaturated it is and everything, I fully understand and get that. And I think anyone who doesn't dig this song is like, yeah, that's fine. But I love it. It just gets me every time. There's just something about this song that just sweeps me up. Everything about wanting to change but being in your mold, and you're a slave for the money, then you die. But also, I think we've talked about so much Britpop over the last few seasons. Pulp, we've talked about Oasis and Blur. And connecting that to the political reality, particularly for young people in Britain at the time, is so important. Like, having their rights stripped away, lack of housing affordability, very few job prospects. Not something we can relate to, but it's so important to connecting it to that music. And then you sort of get to hear, and you get to Urban Hymns and The Verve, and it just feels like there's nothing left.
I'm not saying this as an original thought. I read this on a blog. They were talking about musical movements, and to them they said the 90s started with Smells Like Teen Spirit, and the 90s ended with Bittersweet Symphony. And I said, look, I'm not going to verify the dates these things came out, because it doesn't fucking matter. I'm not talking about years. I'm talking about the idea of the 1990s. Started with Smells Like Teen Spirit, this angry young thing saying, here we are, now entertain us. But the end of it, it doesn't matter. You've grown up. The promises that you were promised didn't come true. Your desires fell flat. You're a slave to the money. Then you die. Life is a bittersweet symphony. That is the story of 90s youth. This person went on to say, and if you had a strong connection to a song after that in the 2000s when there was internet accessibility with music, you're entitled to your opinion, but that doesn't matter anymore, because before the internet made accessibility of music so much broader, these two songs, at least for this writer, and I'm inclined to agree, is they were cultural movements that were promoted on mainstream radio and on mainstream television, and that's why it's important, because now you can get your music from anywhere, but before that, everybody was hearing Smells Like Teen Spirit, and that exemplified an idea about youth. And then years later, all those things you wanted didn't come true. It's a bittersweet symphony. And I think that's incredibly articulate. And yeah, like, I think that's a really beautiful way. And it changed the way I interpret the song. Mm. I really like the song. I'm with you. It is overplayed and it is oversaturated and it is overly saccharine, but it is beautiful. As somebody who is, they would never want to get too real on this podcast, but as somebody who is chronically depressed and wants a better life, these kind of songs connect with me in a way that's really sincere and beautiful. And I think that, like, there's something about Ashcroft's writing here that is genuine and sincere in a way that is really, really difficult to do. And I think he's done a really excellent job.
I don't see it as being complete sadness, though. I think
no, it's not complete sadness. No, it's bittersweet.
Yeah. It's the work. Yeah, it's like working through sadness and whatever. I draw a parallel, interestingly, to Britpop, to the kind of thoughts that we were having when we talked about What's the Story of Morning Glory. Wherein that your situation hasn't changed, but your mindset has. The way you're choosing to go about the moment, the day-to-day, you're making a choice in that, and that's where the joy is found. For me, it's not so much a joy as much as it is a resignation. Like, this is like the night that you give up, this is the morning after.
Yeah.
This is
nowhere near as insular and depressing as the drugs don't work.
Oh, no.
No.
Like, that's a personal sorrow.
Yeah.
This is a statement.
The strings at the beginning is the sound of the entire flock of fucks that you had taking flight. Right?
It's like, nice.
There it goes.
There they go.
The video works quite well with that too, because it's just Richard Ashcroft walking down the street and kind 100%. Of unperturbed by everything.
Much the same way that the video of What's the Story Morning Glory was the same kind of thing, you know?
So, yeah. Sidebar. This video was a horrible, horrible influence on me as a child, because I used to just walk down the hallways and barge into people at school because I was reenacting the video.
That rules.
And I got into a lot of trouble for doing it.
You would have.
They were just like, we've noticed you barge into people a lot.
Yeah, have you listened to Urban Hymns?
Yeah, have you seen the video? It's great. So, and Richard Ashcroft, you are a terrible influence on children.
That's beautiful.
Allegedly.
So pretty important to talk about the rights,
yeah,
and that whole saga with this song.
The real bittersweet symphony behind
the song.
Well,
that's it. It's just kind of like, it was really, I guess, a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the strings are sampled from a 1965 Andrew Oldham orchestra arrangement of The Last Time by the Rolling Stones. Which was licensed to The Verve. But then, and this is where I'm definitely putting my bias into the story, and other people would have probably a different interpretation. Once the song kind of blew up, quite a lot because it's an incredible song that connected with a huge amount of people. The Rolling Stones manager, Alan Klein, sort of had a look and was like, oh, actually, I would like some more money, I think. Because,
I would like
of course, Rolling Stones aren't doing very well.
Because the law is that they licensed the original recording, but not the songwriting royalties from the Stones or something.
Yeah.
It's something weird. It's something.
It's very complicated and hard to trace back because there's not as many records kept of the whole thing. Plus, there was a lot of out-of-court settlements.
Yeah. Because also, when the Rolling Stones more or less ripped off a Katie Lang song, they just called her and were like, hey, we're going to put you down as a songwriting credit. Is that cool? And she was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, I guess it's easy for some artists to rip off other artists.
It's
hard like, for some artists to license music from the bigger artists.
Yeah. And like the end of it was that all the money they made from the song is gone, yeah.
Well, that's it. So originally it was a 50-50% split, the Rolling Stones and
Which I was editorialized to say is, quote, pretty fucking generous.
They sued the Verve, took them to court, the judge threw out that arrangement and gave 100% of the royalties to the Rolling Stones and Andrew Oldham.
This legal system is just fucking gangbusters.
It's just so good, right?
Man, it's just hit after hit. If you have money, the law's awesome.
Slight correction on that. It was the original lawsuit was Alan Klein, as you said, the manager of the Rolling Stones. But in 99, Andrew Oldham had his own lawsuit. He was the arranger for the orchestral version that was used, but he didn't see anything from it. So he came in and tried to dip in later as well.
Money, 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 money.
And he had this terrible quote where he was saying that as for Richard Ashcroft, well, I don't know how an artist can be severely damaged by that experience. Songwriters have learned to call songs their children, and he thinks he wrote something. He didn't. I hope he's got over it. It takes a while.
Holy fuck, man. Uh-huh. That is bullshit.
Yeah, and there's this whole thing of Richard Ashcroft having an amazing burn on the Rolling Stones. And I fucking love this. Nathan, would you like to...
No, please.
So after losing the composer credits, he said, well, this is the best song that Jagger and Richards have written in 20 years.
Which is just like, good.
I'm not saying that it was worth losing all the money to get that
definitely
burn
no,
out.
But yeah, you want to go out with a burn, and he had a good one.
It is excellent. And there's this beautiful story... Because it's worth pointing out at this point that a lot of even the original intro strings, while based on Oldham's thing, they were original. Like, Ashcroft came up with those. And, of course, all the lyrics, all the vocal melodies, it was only those six notes.
Super noteworthy. Like, you listen to it and then listen to it the last time. You're not like, oh, my God.
The string arrangement was definitely used as the basis for writing the song, but there's a lot written that isn't that. There's a lot here that is just purely Ashcroft and the Verve. And, like, he performed it live, stripped back, out of necessity. And I'm a million different people from one day. You know? And then he actually was, like, musing after he performed it, going like, hey.
Ultimately, take away the dressing, take away the strings, take away the sample. There's an actual song there.
That's sad in its way, man.
Isn't
it?
Beautiful in a way.
Yeah.
Bittersweet, if you will.
But that's it. It's just like,
in its own sick, sad way, and in the way that I was saying it encapsulates the end of the 90s, it couldn't have been a more appropriate song to happen to.
That's it. When you're a kid, you have these ideas that, like, sure, maybe there's some fat cats in the music industry, but that's cool, you know, but it's like, this it's a broken system,
it's
like everything else.
It's a business.
It's a business, and it's there to serve the people at the top, and that's it. And it's sad. But
beautiful song.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, obviously. This is part of 90s culture. For lack of a better phrase, you know, this song is universal. You can play this at any fucking bar in any country, in any part of the world, and everyone will know it. Everyone will know the words. Everyone will know every last little bit. And assistance from a string arrangement or not, this song has that quality, and you can't take that away from them. This song is such a huge part of people's lives. It's so strange to think that they literally had to give up everything they earned from making this song because this is their legacy. And I reckon that's probably influenced why Richard Ashcroft is seen as such a nasty, bitter human being to this very day.
I would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it does give you that kind of us against the world feeling. This plays in so many situations in your head. Walking through life, just trying to get by, and everyone is getting in your fucking way, and you start pushing back. That's what Bittersweet Symphony is to me. very interesting to see the way that voters worked in the 1997 Hottest 100 because, you know, you got a lot of very, very popular acts, but then they'll pick a song that normally isn't regarded as like a classic hit. Take, for example, number three, we have Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Chubby Checker. Chubby Checker has made it into the Hottest 100, ladies and gentlemen. But it's not any of his classic singles. It's certainly not The Twist. It says here that it's a B-side. It's called Butt Fucking. I get knocked out, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked out, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked out, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked out, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. Wamba Tub Thumping, Getting Knocked Down, etc. Number three. 1997, Hottest 100. Andrew.
David.
Takes a whiskey drink.
I do.
Takes a vodka drink.
Like, on occasion.
Drinks a lager drink.
Yes.
Drinks a cider drink.
Yeah, but yeah, I have, yes.
Sing songs that remind you of the good times.
Yeah.
Sing songs that remind you of the best times.
Yeah.
Oh, Daddy Boy. Qualified. That passes the checklist.
Yeah, Tub Thumping. This is one of the most inescapable songs of the 90s, isn't it?
Yeah.
Everybody fucking knows this song.
You could say that about literally every song we've talked about.
Mm. Before we even talk about the song, I'm sure some people know the weird story of Chumbawamba, but it's worth recounting because they were one of the most fiercely political anarcho-punk bands of the late 80s, early 90s. They were influenced by Public Image Limited, The Fall, and most specifically Crass, to exist as a band as a political statement. Their first record is called Pictures of Starving Children Sell Records, and it's a shot at Bob Geldof and Live Aid things for their overly saccharine use of like market thing like that. So they came out balls to the wall with politics at the forefront. After that, they went on to release albums under pseudonyms like Jesus Christ Limited and make albums of illegally gotten samples. Like, their politics extended into the actual composition of the music. They were a fascinating band. They also incorporated pop music as they went on into the kind of mid-90s, and then they somehow got signed to a major label, and then they released this song, which... And as the band would later go on, they would experiment with world music, a cappella music, folk music. They are one of the biggest one-hit wonders you can possibly fathom, but not in a way that it's as a failure to the band, because they kept making music and seemingly having fun. This was just, for the career of a weird anarcho-punk band, this was an insane mainstream sellout move blip on the radar. But this song itself, still obviously, like as much as it is a sing-along rowdy song that you have definitely fucking heard if you've been in a hostel.
or if you've owned a little thing I like to call a radio.
Yeah, a little thing I like to call a pair of ears.
if you've got two ears and a heart.
And a whiskey drink. And or vodka, cider, or vodka drink. Lager.
Yeah. But like, or if this you've been knocked down.
And got back up.
And then got back up.
It's a political song, right? Like, in its way, it's like a pro-union, like, the working class.
We'll be singing when we're winning.
Yeah. Like,
the workers united, right? Can never be defeated.
It's fully that tone, though, right?
Everything about them is working class. That's yeah. The origins of the band.
Yeah.
The fact that they ever had a hit is a fucking miracle in and unto itself.
Yeah. If you were a definite fan of their anarcho politics, and when they signed to a major label, in this case it was EMI, again, our friends.
Mm-hmm. Friends of the show.
Yeah, friends of the show, EMI and Universal in the US.
Other friends of the show, The Law.
Yeah, and this was their major debut label. Look, as he says on this song, the late lead songwriter, Duncan Bruce, says, it's not our most political or best song, but it brought us back together. The song is about us as a class and as a band. The beauty of it is we had no idea how big it would be. If you dedicate your life to being a political activist and use that in your music, there are inevitably going to be parts where you are unhappy and fighting with the people that you're working with. And then they wrote this song, happened to be a huge fucking hit. They're now selling out goddamn stadiums after having a career playing pubs.
It'd be such a weird gig as well, because like stadium gigs for one-hit wonders.
Yeah, obviously always, yeah.
Weird time.
Yeah. To say this song is overplayed is being generous to how much this is being overplayed. But like as a piece of songwriting, I fucking get it. It's fun. Like, it's embracing. It's like this downtrodden working class person. And you're like, yeah, as Deej verified with me, I have consumed liquid beverages in my life. Some of them have been alcoholic. And it's fun to be rowdy, allegedly. like, rowdy and singing along with your friends is a part of fun culture. And, like, this is obviously a song written for that. It's not about that, in apart from the, he drinks a whiskey drink, he drinks a vodka drink, which is cheesy and annoying, but it's good as well. Like, I get why this song is here. It's bigger than a Triple J, right? Like, it's like a Triple J-sounding song.
I wonder if they just, they picked, like, they were an earlier adopter of it, and were kind of playing it before it got real big, and so listeners still felt an ownership over it.
A wombo.
No, you were right.
A wombo lombo.
Yeah. What do people think? Do we like this song?
Oh, can no, you like it? It's terrible.
I don't know how I meant to engage with it. Past just being like,
I never put it on.
Yes.
I never think, oh, put Tub Thumping on.
Yeah, but you're never fucking complaining when it's on. You know,
yeah, also true. Yeah.
You're not thinking that because everyone else is thinking.
Yeah.
Culture's no, you got fucking get amongst it.
Yeah.
Well, it's a triumph. It's all about triumph. Your fucking team is coming clean.
Okay, it has to be said, not everyone is for it. This was voted by the Rolling Stones 20 most annoying songs of all time poll. It came in at number 12.
The magazine.
Yeah. So, you know, like, it did get people offside. You know what really changed the song for me? Instead of being like an obnoxious radio song or whatever, is in the album version.
The Peter Postlethwaite.
The quote at the beginning.
From
right?
Blast Off.
Right.
So I fucking love Blast Off.
If you've never heard it, the quote is,
I thought that music mattered, but does it bollocks? Not compared to how people matter.
That is the song. That is it. Because it's like, basically, we don't care. We're going to make literally the least pretentious song that we possibly can, because we care about how people interact with music and not necessarily the music itself. Normally, what we hear is the exact opposite. We're hearing music that stands for something greater than the artist itself. This isn't. This is music that is just as big and no bigger than the people who are currently singing it at the time. This song was inspired by a pub, legit.
Yeah.
The name of the pub was in Leeds. It's called the Fort Green. That was legitimately the inspiration for the song. And Boff Whatley from the band also said that it's, you know, it's about the resilience of ordinary people. You say working class, sure, but there's almost like a classlessness in it, in the sense that everyone can enjoy the company of others, camaraderie, and celebration of their own resilience, no matter what you kind of go through. So I like, there is a, weirdly, there's a beauty in it. Like, it's there. Like, you have to almost think about it a little bit, or not, almost. Mm. Like, not think about it too much. You just have to tap into that experience in a way that isn't just, like, the obnoxious radio
noise. If you had never heard it and you were at a bar and it came on a jukebox, it was 1997,
yeah,
and you were kind of drunk and this song came on, you would fucking lean into it.
100%. Or better yet, if you were with a group of friends and, like, you'd never heard it, but then you heard it, like, six times or enough that you could sing along to it.
Yeah, yeah. The oversaturation kills it. But
yeah.
It's a baller and a fun song.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say was there's this funny little anecdote here. They're partly inspired by a different UK band who are more of a dance band and sample-driven but equally anarchic, called the KLF.
Yeah.
Or they went by various names, like the Justified Ancients of Moo Moo. And they were a band that were notoriously illegally sampling things from the Beatles to Queen and ABBA. Things that they are inevitably going to get called up for.
Nice.
And then releasing it themselves and putting it in record stores and then getting in trouble. Very funny. Like, I've spoken about artistic purity and how much I respect it. The KLF were the purest band in the world because they had a number one hit with a song that samples Rock and Roll Number 2 by Gary Glitter.
Hey!
And mashes it up with Doctor Who sounds, and they released it under the name The Time Lords. And then when they were going to perform it on Top of the Pops, they said, well, the car plays it. So they had to put a car on stage to press play. And they Google it. Time Lords, the song is called Rockin' the TARDIS. And it just goes like, it's the funniest thing in the world. And they had a number one hit with that. Like, it was
Oh, England is broken.
And then they wrote and released a book by the KLF, the manual, how to have a number one hit the easy way. Told you step by step how to have a number one hit. And there's a photo before this song came out of Chumbawamba reading that book.
Wow.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Later on, the KLF, because I have to tell my favourite anecdote from the history of music, when they all the money they got from their entire career, when they broke up and refused to reform ever, they wanted to give it to, like, when there was the new wave of young British artists were coming out, doing, like, this confronting kind of experimental work. When they were going to announce the best one of that, the KLF then announced that they were going to give money to the worst artist in Britain, and they picked the person who would, an hour later, be awarded the best artist in Britain. And they said, like, and then she's like, well, I'd take the money, I guess.
And they're like, what do you do in that situation?
And then later on, all the money they made from their entire KLF career, they had $1 million, and then they went out to into an island somewhere and burned it. They just burned all the money they made, which was £1 million. And then they released that as a film called The K Fantasian Burn $1 million. And that's the end of their career.
Wow.
They are purer than you can dream of. And they kind of inspired this hit. Because I'm never going to get a chance to talk about them. Yeah. So, yeah.
I'm glad you did, though.
Yeah.
Remix episode. I also think it's interesting just looking at the band while this song was happening and it was so popular, because they were still trying to really live their politics or whatever,
yeah,
while being like a number one band. Or
a number one EMI band.
Yeah, exactly. There's like, Nutter was quoted in Melody Maker saying, "Nothing can change the fact that we like it when cops get killed." Obviously, especially in Britain, where the tabloid press loves outrage, got in a lot of trouble, but didn't even back down. They commented by saying, if you're working class, they won't protect you when you hear about them. It's in the context of them abusing people. We don't have a party when cops die. You know we don't. And it's like, that's huge. But then also, like, they sold the song to General Motors for an ad and donated all the money from that to an environmental campaign against General Motors, which is super interesting and, like, awesome. But then at the end of the day, I kind of think 20 years on, we still have that song as a pop song.
And General Motors can still use it in ads.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I can't help but feel that it's just like, you know, once again, it's just the industry swallowing you up despite your best efforts to try and change the system from within, because it just doesn't really work like that. Mm. Also, I forgot to say before when we were talking about Bittersweet Symphony, but it makes me mad, so I'd like to say it now. The Rolling Stones manager who ripped them off so badly,
Alan Klein,
kind of jumped on the fact that Richard Ashcroft hated his music being used in advertising and sold the song to heaps of ads like Nike and stuff, which is just like,
God, villainous.
What a cock.
Man, that's just...
Andrew's there just taking notes. It's just like, right, this is how you be a villain. Into it.
That is good.
It's like just an absolute scum move. Anyway, this song is incredible and an incredible thing to have happened.
Yeah, this song is beyond critical, like, discussion to a certain degree.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
And my notes might be incorrect on this one.
No.
Well, they've been accurate so far.
I know. I've never led you guys astray in the past. But it's telling me this song is by Oasis. So they have made it back into the charts somehow, some way. What's the pronunciation on this? I think it's...
Woo!
It wasn't easy, but nothing is. No. When I'm feeling the metal, and I'm feeling the old, when I lie and I'm easy, all of the time, but I'm never sure.
Song 2, number 2, 1997, Triple J, Hottest 100, quick, Matt's motherfucker. This song is song 2 because it is 2 minutes and 2 seconds. It is the second song on their second album. There's two choruses and two verses.
That's and it came it. In at number two.
They wrote it specifically because they knew it was going to come in at number two in the 1997 Hottest 100.
But also, it only peaked at number two on the charts.
But I wonder, right, like, if you were the person who's tallying the votes or looking at the Billboard list that year, like, you could very easily just, like, it came in at number three, let's put it at number two. It makes more sense, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Fuck, oh, great. Now I'm going to have to get Robert Mueller in here to fucking investigate the 97 countdown.
This is all just allegedly.
Allegedly. I don't think there is anyone in this room that does not have an affinity for this song and immediately sparks reminiscence of childhood and, like, primary school discos and pub cover bands and FIFA games, just ads, TV, everywhere. This song has been omnipotent and omnipresent since it first came out. It's 21 this year, which means it is legally allowed to drink everywhere and it's going out to get fucking smashed. And why wouldn't you? It's very, very peculiar because it's antithetical to everything Blur. But, like, usually when rock bands have a big hit, it's their ballad. Look at, like, Extreme, Mr. Big, Faith No More, even Green Day around this point. Like, all of their biggest hits were their acoustic ballads that sounded nothing like the rest of their discography. Whereas Blur, you know, were kind of catchy, sensible, fun pop rock band that wrote the heaviest alt-rock song that they'd ever written, and that ended up becoming their signature song.
It's so funny. For years, before I was familiar with Blur at all, and when people were saying, like, the Blur Oasis beef, and this is me not being a Britpop aficionado, but I'm like, why would you compare those bands? Like, Song 2 sounds nothing like Oasis. Like, I had no idea. Like, for years, I'm like, that's the Blur sound. It's not at all, obviously.
This song relies on, we've talked about it in the past, the Smells Like Teen Spirit dynamics, which, again, they stole from the Pixies. The Loud, Quiet, Loud, and also reflecting on what isn't playing in the song. You open with Dave Rowntree, boom, da, ba, da, boom, da, bam,
one
boom,
of the most iconic opening drum beats of all time.
Like 2 seconds of that, everyone knows what's happening.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
The second that's there, it's on. And then Graham Coxon comes in with one of the most recognizable riffs of the 90s. So you open up, no guitar, no bass, no vocals. Then you've got guitar and drums. And then it all kicks in like a fucking shitstorm. Just boom. And then you have the second half of the intro happen again in that verse, but with vocals this time. And the vocals are very sporadic. Yep. You're paying attention to, like, okay, we're back to this part of me again. But it's about to kick off again. Like, I know.
Yeah, it's just anticipation from the very beginning. Like, it sets
it's like,
up that without
like
even knowing
drop.
The song.
It's just like, you know it's coming. Yeah. You know it's coming and shit's going to get fucking very, very real very, very quickly when it does.
But you don't even have to have any, like with EDM, you kind of have to know, I mean, you could feel it out a bit, I guess, but you know the genre and you know that there's going to be a drop. Whereas I feel like this teaches you what's going to happen immediately. Mm. And then the rest of the song, you can anticipate that happening again. Which
just
is awesome.
Just because it's the same riff, like the loud and quiet parts is the same thing is happening. When it drops back, you're not out of this big thing. You still have the really heavy moment lingering and you know it's just a step away again.
True, it's like an echo.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, this is what you're left with. I think it's interesting that you brought up Smells Like Teen Spirit as a comparison point because many people think that this song was written as a parody of grunge. That's
I heard
a rumor.
That. Yeah.
I can
but
see that.
It doesn't make sense, really, and like there's no evidence from the band that is the case. Mm. Apparently, making good on my thing that I said way at the beginning of the countdown, talking about songs being spontaneous, this is the ultimate example of that. This is like Blur, in their own words, like being hungover as hell from whatever they did the night before, getting in the studio and just coming up with this and realizing that they had something there. And apparently it was based on the kind of stuff that they used to jam out when they first started as a band. So they just went back to their just having fun and they went, oh, actually, that's kind of good.
We've accidentally wrote a major hit.
And then they were
this
like,
jumbo jetline is really going to speak to people.
Apparently, what proceeded from that was them kind of being heaps anxious that they hadn't done enough. Because it was just there. Like, they did the track. And they were like, oh, but normally we have to work so much harder on songs. Should be. And it's like just them doing something and going like, no, it was better before.
I can
imagine
that.
Kind of like not fiddling with it. But yeah, I can't see any evidence that it was a grunge parody.
And it'd be a bit passe, like this many years later.
Exactly.
Like, we're coming after grunge.
That's the main thing. It's just kind of like, you've already...
Like Weird Al did it in 98. It's just like, dude, what are you doing? Kurt's dead.
Yeah, it would be
we
a bit...
We beat Oasis, now we're coming after Nirvana.
Well, hey! Exactly. Oh, man. One of the main things that I remember about this song is... how much it is, you know, for better or for worse, associated with fucking lads, man. The fucking lads get around this fucking song. And I have never seen that more embodied than when I saw Blur live in 2015 at the Sydney Entertainment Centre. Dave Rowntree kicks off the drums. Everyone is going fucking bunter. And then fucking ringleader Damon Albarn, he starts a chant that goes over the top of the beat. So boom, 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 boom. Here we fucking go!
Here we fucking go!
Here we fucking go! And I'm like, yes! This is sick! People were going so fucking crazy. One dude in the stands, like up in the seats, was so excited that he fucking leapt over the top of the fucking barrier where the seats were to jump into the fucking crowd.
Huge.
I was like, fucking right, dude. Go fucking hard, son. You have paid the babysitter in full. This is your fucking night, dad.
It is fully one of those songs that like encouraged that kind of like... primordial like reptile brain where you're like you have to
like top thumping
you have to respond.
No one is left standing by the time those two songs are played back to back in the barbecue
and they're gearing up for number one the biggest one of them all.
But like it's such a physical track, right? Like, it's never something that I think to myself, oh, I'm dying to hear song two. I've never put it on because everybody knows it intimately as it is. But like whether or not you like it is kind of beside the point because it works exactly how it should work. It's an incredibly well done song.
Mm.
It is good. Like,
it's an adrenaline shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's pure distilled energy transmitted via audio.
It's always been the car ad song for me.
Heaps
of cars. Of course.
Just like...
we've had a few car ad songs come through.
When I think of car ad songs, I think of this one. I think there's probably one particular car ad that I end up seeing like a lot as a kid or whatever.
Like, the opening riff is like a distant shot of a car on a mountain, and then it does the woohoo, and it cuts up real close of the car, so I'm pulling a mad turn.
Exactly. So, I don't even, you know, you're talking about discos and stuff, I don't really have a memory of it outside of
cars.
That kind of thing. And like, fairly... you know, as a teenager or whatever, connecting the dots, like you said, we're like, all right, that's Blur. Oh, and they sound like this?
Well, this was the first song that I ever heard from Blur.
Yeah,
fully.
So I didn't really have a sense of what Blur were. In fact, but I always had the chronology completely arsed backwards. I thought that this Blur's self-titled was their first album, just because I thought, like...
It's self-titled.
Kind
like,
of.
That's classic.
But yeah, I mean, you know, like the simple, heavy song... And then, you know, you could look at songs like Park Life and very easily connect them to later kind of indie rock.
In the country.
Yeah,
100%. I love that song.
But it makes sense that, like, if this was, like you said, Adam, they're, them going back to their roots in terms of how they just jammed out. Because it is obviously a jammed out song, right? Like, the fact that you could just have a chorus and go, woohoo!
And the lyrics are so nonsense. Like, they're clearly just kind of thrown together and be like, you know what? That'll do. Like, that's what this song needs.
I remember a mate of mine when I was a kid... got his dad or someone gave him a crew cut and he really fucking hated it, and this song came out then and we used to tease him relentlessly by saying I got my head shaved, and he hated it. So I think that one I hit this song as well. Sorry, Sam.
Wait, is there a second line to the teasing?
I don't know, I was fucking 9.
Can I quickly bring up a completely nonsensical Mondegreen that I think maybe people my age might sympathize with? I got my head shaved by a jumbo jet. Didn't think it was that. Didn't think it was, you know, real words. Thought it was someone named Ichumboche. I got my head shaved by Ichumboche.
You're talking about the mask that gives you invincibility in Crash Bandicoot.
What have I got?
Really?
No. Oh. Just kind of sounds like it.
Oh, God. It's a thing I didn't know. So, like, I don't think I knew the lyrics until, like, maybe a year ago, maybe. Because why would I ever know the lyrics to this?
You can basically just make phonetic noises at this song.
And it gets you there.
But that gets you there. That's the thing,
oh,
right?
Dude, so fucking physical,
that just, like... vowels are enough.
Like, yeah. Huge. Yeah. It's huge and true.
It's crazy thinking about this top 10, and a top 10 with Paranoid Android, one of the kind of most
heady,
complex and heady songs to do well in the 90s. We have, like, also, you know, Leaving Home, which is such, like, a simple...
Spontaneous fun,
like really punk influenced, and just kind of like, you know, Kevin talked about the lyrics just sort of coming together or whatever. Yep. And then songs like this right next to that. Like, I think that's very cool. And it shows a really good diversity of music in Australia at this point in time, in terms of what people are into, that you can kind of have that highbrow and lowbrow stuff.
Mm. And if you're trying to write a good song, maybe you're trying too hard.
Yeah.
Maybe true. Just sometimes
or not hard enough. But the point is, how hard you're trying right now is incorrect.
That's right. You need to either try more. If that doesn't work,
I'd try less. If you can get it by trying less, surely you want to do that first.
I have lived much of my life trying less and seeing if it works out. Yeah. Oh, I mean, this is hard. Maybe if I put less effort in, I'll finish the race.
I was thinking, though, I can't think of many Australian acts that kind of fit that heady, like your Radiohead, your Björk, your artists that, like, are kind of experimental, but still in a fairly accessible way, but kind of have a richness of... that you can really dive into those songs. And I can't think of
Silverchair?
Any... Silverchair? Maybe. I've never considered them like that.
Well, think about, like, Neon Ballroom and Diorama.
Mm. Sure.
Let me tell you about Melbourne band Tism.
I'm on the drum!
Obviously Tism. But, like, I don't know who Australia's Radiohead is, just in terms of an audience engaging...
I don't think we have a Radiohead.
No.
I don't think we're smart enough to have a Radiohead.
I wonder that, like... I think there's probably a bunch of things that go into that, like cultural cringe and, like, maybe just because of Australia's music history in terms of, like, pub rock and that,
where that's what I was thinking.
Not predisposed to that kind of music.
Mm. Also, I know a huge spectrum of pop culture has an anti-intellectual inherentness, but Australia has definitely, like, a larrikinism and ochre thing.
Yeah.
Early, like, even, like, with punk rock, like Radio Birdman and the Saints, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Incredible acts, but, like, not super heady in the... Yeah. Even, like... In the 90s, like one of the best in terms of, like, songwriting, like UMI, right? Like, Owly Daily isn't, like, complex and heady. It's sincere and from the heart.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And that's not to, like, diminish it.
No. Like, we have all these amazing bands, but they don't really fit the same mold as... It'd be weird if they did.
Yeah, you know? Totally.
Like, I can't imagine Australia having a Radiohead that is, like, on that level.
Yeah.
We have acts that sound like Radiohead, sure as shit, but they are not.
And we have some really good experimental acts, like Nico Nico comes to mind. Yeah. Like, even Marcus Whale, like, I think there's a lot going on in his music, but it doesn't approach the same level of success. I wonder as well if it's not, like, obviously because they're foreign, but Björk and Radiohead, by the time they get to, like, the music gets to Australia, it's already kind of signed off by a lot of, like, critical consensus as good, important music.
Mm.
And I wonder if it would be hard for an Australian act to, you know, just that thing that, like, maybe Australians need other people to say something's good before we like it, if it's that kind of thing. I don't know.
Listeners, if you do know this answer, please hit us up. Because if you're, like, screaming at the headphones, or maybe you're sitting on a fucking speaker, that'd be weird.
Yeah.
Could be in a car.
Yeah, I guess.
In a podcast in a car.
I don't know.
They've separated the tracks out. They've got a separate speaker for all of our voices with little cutouts of our heads above each one.
I would love someone to have a Zyreka version of this podcast.
Yeah, but maybe you know there's, like, dude, why aren't you talking about fucking whoever? Tell us, because I want to hear this.
I mean, like, specifically from the 90s, or do you think just across?
Anywhere along the line.
Okay.
I'm going to bring down the intellectual discussion just to wrap this up and mention that back in January, I saw Papa Roach. They covered this, and it was fucking awesome.
You!
Yeah!
Okay.
It was fucking sick.
Bug Daddy.
Second best song of the night.
I'm sorry, Bug Daddy?
Bug Daddy. Papa Roach, yeah.
Quick maths.
Quick maths. I can't believe this. 99 songs down, one to go. And it is a deep cut, but for somehow, some way, this has made it into the ether, into the history of Australian music. At number one, we have a track from the late, great Gough Whitlam. Now, interestingly, this is the second ever Australian number one, but this also holds a different record with the longest song title in the history of the Hottest 100.
What is that title, David?
The song title is... Well, may we say God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General. The proclamation which you have just heard read by the Governor General's official secretary was countersigned by Malcolm Fraser, who will undoubtedly go down in Australian history from Remembrance Day 1975 as Kerr's Kerr. They won't silence the outskirts of Parliament House, even if the insides have been silenced for the next few weeks. Maintain your rage and enthusiasm for the campaign, for the election now to be held, and until polling day.
The big one.
A letter to you on a cassette, 'cause we don't write anymore. Gotta make it up quickly. There's people asleep on the second floor. There's no aphrodisiac like loneliness. Truth, beauty, and a picture of you. You'll be walking your dog in a few hours. I'll be asleep in my brother's house. You're a thousand miles away with food between your teeth. Come up for summer, I've got a place near the beach. There's room for your dog. There's no aphrodisiac like loneliness. Truth, beauty, and a picture of you.
The Whitlams at number one in the 1997 Hottest 100 with No Aphrodisiac.
You.
Dead set clappies.
Dead set clappies.
Dead set clappies.
Oh, that's a good one. We haven't done that for a while.
Yeah.
Nice throwback, Adam.
It's going back a bit.
We've discussed, well, we're about to get into our fifth discussion of the most popular song of the year. Nathan, the Whitlams, you love them.
I do love them.
Yeah, you've gone on record saying they're one of your favourite bands. Is this your favourite song of 1997?
I think I'd still go with Louis Burdett.
Okay, so why not this?
Oh, I mean, this is obviously...
Why do you hate this song? Why do you hate Australia?
I think this song is trite, I think it's uninteresting, and...
Come on, mate, we're not talking about Kevin Mitchell anymore.
I don't even know... I'm sure someone doesn't like this song, and they probably have terrible reasons for it. Andrew, how's it going?
Oh, whoa!
No, I like this song. This is a great song. I guess a bit of context. We've talked about the Whitlams several times now, including earlier this season with You Sound Like Louis Burdett. We also talked about I Make Hamburgers in last season for the 1996 countdown.
Which we cocked up the meaning of.
Yeah, apparently. Jeez. Felt like such a child.
Yeah,
people were like, it's about sex. I'm like, what?
He's a pig.
I thought it was just about the Burgers. Less funny, so on the broadcast day of the 1996 Hottest 100, which is January 26th of 1997,
yes.
Stevie Plunder, original member of the Whitlams, was found dead at the base of a waterfall. Terribly, terribly sad. Andy had, I think, already left the band by this point, or at least they were kind of in a nebulous state.
Andy wasn't in the band at this
point. So the band kind of, like, stops being a band at this point, and Tim goes away for a while, but then he comes back, and there's this beautiful... This is just like, you know, a phoenix rising from the ashes. He comes back with a whole bunch of songs. All the personnel on the album changed nearly every song because he didn't have money to pay anyone properly. So he was just getting in whoever he could for every session. The songs were all recorded separately. And the way it was thrown together is like almost ramshackle in the way it was just kind of...
Wow.
Like, here's a bunch of songs, and he wanted to make the record, but had so few resources to do it.
Now, I was going to say, because on the next record, there's a lot of different people that play on that album as well, but my favourite person that plays on Love This City is INXS bassist, who has my favourite name of anyone ever, Gary Beers. The great man.
The great man.
GGB.
Yeah.
Yeah. This album's kind of thrown together... kind of, yeah, in a sort of ramshackle way, coming out of a huge tragedy as well.
Yeah.
And then I really like the story. Once they sort of finished, Tim got the core team together and they all wrote out their idea of what a track listing might be for the album. And it's a big, I think, 17 tracks, Eternal Nightcap.
Yeah.
It's a solid album. Like, yeah, there's a lot going on there. And even though no one had kind of flagged this song as like a single or anything, and all the track listings everyone wrote were different, everyone put this as the first track, which is really lovely, I think. Interesting. It's just a beautiful song. I think it kind of straddles this really beautiful space between starting out so seriously and it's quite lovely and feels like a lonely song, and then moving into this really weird space by the end. There's members of Machine Gun Fellatio.
That's right. We're
helping out with the lyrics and all that stuff because they're just good friends, because Sydney bands, I guess.
Pinky, Beecroft and Chit Chat.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's just great. I love it. I think there's a real simplicity in how the song moves through all those sections, and like everything is just kind of doing his job. And Tim is just a great songwriter and a great singer. And even though this is like not the characterful song that Louis Badet is, there's still so much character in it right from the start. Those details about you're 1,000 miles away with food between your teeth. It's just,
it's so, so fucking human. It's one of those, right? Like, in terms of this countdown, and it's very, in its way, it's suitable that it is number one, because the one thing that we've spoken about in the 90s is like sincerity and irony and the clashes between those and how songwriters have responded to that. And this, the Whitlams do both really fucking well. And this, like again, like it's kind of playful by the end, but like this, it's so human and sincere. And even just saying there's no aphrodisiac like loneliness, it's a sickeningly human, beautiful thing, yeah, right? I do prefer Lube Dead as well, because I think it's more fun or whatever. Well, it's obviously more fun. This is not fun.
I think it might be more fun.
Yeah. This was obviously like, probably for me, it's been overplayed a touch just because it's like so popular and huge, but like, it never feels overly saccharine though.
Mm.
It's just, it's a fucking beautiful song. I don't think Tim gets enough chops as a singer, but like here he's really, he suits his sound so, so warmly.
He's just lazing into it. Yeah. Really. Like, he's just letting it kind of come out, which is what I think is so much about this song, based on talking about the writing of it and it being human. Like, this is a short story. It just happens to be set to music. Like, the way that it's written and the way that it's composed and everything. My favorite detail about this song is how quickly it gets to the first chorus. And he says, like, we don't write anymore. We've got to make it up quickly. To me, it's like this guy has just spent, like, the evening feeling shitty and longing after this person. He's downed a couple of glasses of wine. And he's come up with this line. And he has to let this person know that. And he doesn't actually have the rest of the letter yet, or the rest of the thing that he wants to say to them ready yet. He doesn't have it ready yet, but he knows that bit, so he gets to it straight away.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And then the rest, he just kind of makes it up as he goes along, to the point where he gets to the end and it's just classifieds, weird classifieds that he's found. And, like, originally I didn't like it. Like, I was so on board with the song, talking about imagining being together and all that really connected stuff between one person and another. And then it gets to the classifieds bit, and I'm just kind of like, this is just a bit silly. But I've since come to really love it because it's other people's loneliness presented in this really absurd light. And even the fact that you could imagine this character reading through the classifieds, trying to find someone in lieu of this other person that he really wants to spend time with, and only coming up with this, like, these weird, bizarre descriptions of what people are looking for, but they're looking for that earnestly.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, you know, it's an Eleanor Rigby, All the Lonely People kind of moment. Like, look at the weird things that loneliness makes us seek.
Yeah,
look at the weird ways we buy. Yeah.
Yeah, like the suck on my finger after you've had some nice wine or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, look at the way that we are so desperate to be with one another and whatever. It's so weird that this got number one, though. Don't you think?
You reckon? It's like, it's hugely appealing.
I reckon at the time, people would have just been like, wait, really? And then with a bit of space and a bit of time to reflect, it's just like, you know what? This deserved that. You know,
I mean,
like,
we can look at it and go easily, oh, of course this is number
one.
Because
like, we have the 2020 hindsight, but like,
it's weird for the time.
I think at first it might have been a bit of a surprise, but I think people, you know, came to realize the importance of this song and the emotional weight of this song. And like, it's weird that something could be so uniquely specific and yet people empathize and relate to it. You know, there's a real sense of, yeah, I've been in this position. Like, not specifically down to the bone. Maybe they were walking with their cat in a few hours or some shit. You know?
sleeping at their sister's house.
Yeah. But, like, you know what I mean? Like, Tim has always had that way of telling stories that are very directly about him and his own life and his own stories. and yet they are universal enough to be able to picture yourself in them. And I think that reflects on Eternal Nightcap as a whole. I think this is a record about grief and about death and about friendship and about loving the people in your life even when they disappoint you and when they let you down. And as directly personal as this is a record for Tim, you also get so much out of those stories and you kind of sense yourself within them. On my first album, there's a song called In Love With This Girl and With Her Town as well, which is named after a lyric from Melbourne, which is on this album. I took inspiration from that song, like, in one tiny little way and, you know, turned it into something completely different. And I reckon a bunch of songwriters have done the same with so many Whitlam songs. Mm. We can look at them as, you know, they're obviously they're a bit naff, they're a bit cheesy, you know, they're so earnest. They are the whitest white band to ever white, but, like, God damn, if I don't hear that descending piano and just fall into a fucking heap, like, fuck, I'm done, I'm under.
That's the thing, like, when you said that, but, like, it's, like, naff or whatever like that, it's only naff because we've been conditioned to view everything with a lens of fucking irony. Because
totally.
Because we poisoned ourselves as people. Yeah. like, it's embarrassing to show sincere love. You get caught off guard if somebody you're not expecting it says something really sincere to you, like, look, I'm having a really difficult time right now, but I really love your friendship. That's a hard thing to hear. And like, those kind of sincere moments. And the Whitlams channel that so well. And you can't, like, that's the thing right between sincerity and irony that I mentioned before, that they do them so well. And it's only naff if you refuse to let it hold you properly. It really wants to hold you properly. And if you let it, it's just fucking beautiful. Yeah, he's a damn good writer.
Hmm. Yeah.
Sure, I'm the first to say that about Tim.
Yeah.
Dude can write a good tune.
I'm sure he appreciates it.
You know who also appreciated it? Mr. Gough Whitlam.
Oh, yeah.
We need to go off on this one.
Didn't he introduce them at the Arias?
Yeah. And he announced it in the countdown.
Yeah, a good
story about that. When they saw him on stage at the Arias, Tim's like sitting in the crowd being like, that is fucking cruel, man. How dare they, like, just thought it was a guest presenter. How dare they get Gough Whitlam up there doing something like that and we're not winning it. That is grade A cruelty, man. I can't fucking believe that. He just didn't connect it. Oh. And they said it and he was like, oh, right, that's why they got him. Like, oh, okay. Like, and he's like, oh, sick, yes, there you go.
It's actually good because everyone organising it would have been like, oh, it's going to be so obvious as soon as Gough is here that the Whitlams will win it.
Guys, Tim in the audience was like, oh, you just fucking... having a word to him afterwards.
Oh, bloody hell.
This is bullying. Yeah, very beautiful.
And they became, like, good friends, which is really nice.
Yeah, I'm just not really a humble brave, but I did get to meet Gough Whitlam once, and he was a very humble man and a giant. He's, like, taller than me, and I'm, like, 6'4".
And very funny.
Yes, yeah. Bit of a charity, dude. Have we any more comments? This is the end of the fucking countdown, lads. We did another season.
Oh my god.
I'm looking forward to the shortens in 2027. Taking out the top.
Mm. That would be, oh man.
That would be so shit.
Yeah.
But the shortens is actually a pretty good name for a band. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Has anyone else noticed that the shortens sound exactly like the fucking Turnbulls?
Oh, we're getting a bit political in here.
That was our best political joke yet.
I thought you guys were the alternative band.
Sound pretty mainstream to me, mate. But great that, like, second Australian winner in a row.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very nice.
The big two.
Aussie.
Yeah.
Hey. Yeah.
That's good.
Mm.
It's been a good countdown.
Do we have any broad thoughts?
What a fun time.
What a hoot.
I think I kind of made my point when we were talking about Jebediah that I think this has been a countdown of, like, a lot of
up-and-coming film.
The new era of Australian music.
We've had some cries.
Kind of establishing it itself.
And also just, like, getting across the huge year for music that 1997 was.
Yes.
Fairly broadly and accurately. Like, when you... Yeah.
It's fascinating that there are so many giants in this countdown and so many, like... What the fuck is this song moments? Yeah.
But we're on the tail end of, like, your Matars being able to get in the countdown,
yeah,
I reckon.
Yeah.
Done.
Making the hottest 100 less weird.
Yeah, it gets less weird from here.
Mm. But there are some banging tunes in the next year.
Oh man, next year's huge.
Mm. Oh, I will looking say, like, a lot of people, you know, when we started this season was just like, oh, I can't wait for 97, that's my favourite countdown. And... I don't agree with that, like, personally, but I can appreciate where they're coming from, especially when you look at this top 10, because this top 10 is probably the biggest one that we've ever talked about.
Yeah,
and definitely. Like, songs that have gone on to define an era, you know, like, some of the biggest songs of all time are in this top 10. So, this might be my favorite top 10. Not my favorite top 100, but probably my favorite top 10.
Yeah, I think maybe the highs are higher than in other countdowns. Yes. But, like, even next year, I think across the board, it's pretty incredible. Even just, like, you know, we were talking about the first 10 we'll cover, and the bands involved are kind of
big
top 10 material. Like, it's weird. It's going to be good.
Hey, one thing we should check off on, and maybe no notice on this, but Champs and Chumps.
I was thinking that, Champs and Chumps.
It's time to end the ever-continuing story.
It's not continuing. We haven't had a sting yet. Do you want a sting?
Ooh, too late now. We'll do one for next season.
All right, forget it.
Yeah. No.
No sting. Stingless.
Damn it. No.
Sting.
Shuggy. All right, bitches, let's sort this shit out. We need to pick our favorites and our least favorites from the top 10. I think our names can all officially be changed to Sophie at this point, because we got some fucking choices to make.
I'm going to be ruthless. My fave of the 10 was Paranoid Android. My least fave was Beautiful People, but I still do like that song.
As if it's not Damn It.
Oh, it is Damn It. I forgot what we were talking about. I fucking hate that piece of shit. Yeah, academically, it's Damn It. Sorry, Marilyn Manson. I'll remove a rib in your honor. yeah, my favorite was Paranoid Android.
Huge if true.
Least favorite, Damn It. My champ of the countdown, I believe, is going to be Nick Cave Into My Arms. My chump of the countdown is fucking Baz. Sunscreen song.
Yeah. Can I just say Snap? I also, for my favorite and my least favorite for the top 10, and I would like to declare Paranoid Android as my ultimate champ.
Nice.
What about ultimate chump?
No, it's Baz. I guess.
Who had a hand in creating the champ?
So, you know, what better way to illustrate the true struggle?
The duality of man.
That's the eternal struggle.
That's it. Yeah.
All right. By default, my least favorite of the 10 was Backdoor Man. I love the story, but musically, like, everything else comes way, way before it. And I think my favorite of the top 10... like, as much as I love all these songs, I might have to go with Bittersweet Symphony. Yeah, if I'm
nice.
Honest.
Nice.
It was worth knocking down all those kids.
Yes, indeed. But my carryover champ and winner of the Hottest 100 is Prisoner of Society.
Well done. Good choice. Well done.
And carryover chump, like, I want to say Baz, but, like, we put up with Beaver Loop for so fucking long.
You're gonna go back. You're like, gonna renege.
Like, you're gonna open the loop. Like, if we're going overall, the worst song in the countdown.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I reckon it could be Beaver Loop.
Wow. Like,
wow.
Wow.
I thought the loop was closed.
Yeah. I think I'll say my favorite of top 10 is Paranoid Android. It's very hard to pick.
Over even No Aphrodis.
Yeah, I don't know. It's difficult.
Hmm.
For many reasons, but I'm just going to go with that. But my champ will remain Louis Bidette. Academically, my least favorite is Beautiful People, but the chump far and away will remain Baz.
Yep. Hey, so that's that for the 10.
And that's that for the 100.
That's that for the 100. The that's big hundo.
Season 5, baby. Season
500 five, baby. Songs down.
Mm.
500 songs.
It's hard to tell.
Plus the remix episode.
I can't do the math for that.
Plus the 100 that we talked about in the
That's true.
In
that's the true.
First episode.
Pretty sure our 100th episode was recent, but we missed it.
Yeah, and stay tuned for the 1,000th episode. We'll probably forget that too.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Before we get out of here, let's just do our own credits. I want to give a massive thank you to FBI Radio for having us, as always.
Absolute legends. Couldn't be a better station in Sydney.
If you wanted to support FBI as well, there's ways to do that. Check them out on the web as well. Definitely worth doing it. Easy and cheap.
Yeah, absolutely. Easy, cheap. You win heaps of free tickets to stuff. It's great.
It's sick. FBIRadio.com. Thanks to everyone that contributed to our remix episode. Thanks to everyone that has been supporting the podcast, leaving us reviews, all that. that good stuff, you know, getting amongst the discourse.
Yeah.
It's been very much appreciated. Big thanks to Kevin Mitchell for being a part of the podcast as well and having a chat with our boy A-Bunch. It was very fucking cool of you. Really, yeah. really appreciate it.
It was really cool.
And, yeah, we would like to dedicate this season to two alums of the Hottest 100 that are sadly no longer with us, Dolores O'Riordan from the Cranberries and Grant Fell from Headless Chickens, who sadly both passed away this year. And I would like to extend my thanks to the three gentlemen in front of me for once again going along with my crazy idea.
We're in too deep now.
Sub 41 style.
Couldn't be happier, David. Thank you for hosting with your handsome ways. And listeners as well, sincerely.
Yeah.
Do leave us a review. Yeah, 5 stars only, you know the rules.
Accept nothing less.
Yeah, save your 4 stars for Cumtown or the other weird podcast you probably listen to.
What?
It's a podcast.
Oh, God. Yeah, it's a real podcast. Yeah. Look it up, man. All right, well, in the interim between season 5 and season 6, we're all going on holidays to the Bahamas. So
I'm
going to
grow as a person.
Yes, we are really going to grow, and we are going to get some serious suntans. So, guys, the bus is waiting outside, so let's get the fuck out of here, and let's go to our holiday destination.
There is a bus outside the window.
I fucking called that shit.
Oh, my God.
On behalf of Mr. Adam Buncher.
See ya.
Mr. Andrew McDonald.
Catch you on the forum.
Mr. Nathan. Harrison!
Thanks.
My name is David James Young. Everything is good for you. Peace out, motherfucker. Sweet potato, drop that beat!